Welcome back to In Focus with David Coletto. I'm David Coletto. On this episode of In Focus, I'm joined by author and activist Seth Klein. Last year, Seth's book, A Good War, Mobilizing Canada for the Climate Emergency, was published by ECW Press. In it, he argues that in order to meet the climate crisis head-on, Canada will need to mobilize like it did during World War II. Sharing strategies used during the war, he shows that the change and effort needed to tackle the climate crisis can also create jobs and reduce inequality. I had the pleasure of working with Seth on an important aspect of the book, an exclusive custom public opinion survey exploring public attitudes and opinions about climate change and what Canadians are willing to do to confront it. On the podcast, we spoke about his book, Public Opinion and Climate Change in Canada, and what the pandemic has taught us about our ability to mobilize and work together to address a crisis collectively. I highly recommend picking up a copy of the book, A Good War. Here's my chat with Seth Klein. Well, Seth, real pleasure to see you and to talk to you about this. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Good to be here, David.
So first off, congrats on a real impressive and compelling book. I think you pulled together so much history. It's as much a history book as it is about the future, which I really love. So even if you don't start off thinking, you know, we really need to do something about climate change, learning about what we were able to do in response to the war, I think is really interesting. I guess I want to start with, you know, why did you write this book and why this frame in terms of how you approached it?
Mm-hmm. Well, the truth is I wrote the book because I was increasingly panicked and alarmed, particularly as a parent. This is the first book I've ever written. And as you know, before writing the book, I was 22 years at the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. And when you are at the CCPA, you're forever in that space between what you believe is necessary and possible and what our political leaders seem willing to consider. And no more so when it comes to climate, right? Where mm-hmm. all of us who pay attention to this stuff and read the scientific warnings live in this space, this harrowing gap between what the science says we have to do and what our politics seems prepared to entertain. So when I set off to write the book, I wanted to tackle that gap. And in particular, this dynamic that I call the new climate denialism, which is different from the old school denialism. What I mean by the new climate denialism is those governments and leaders who say they get and accept the science, but continue to practice a politics that does not align with what the science says we have to do. And I wanted to write a book that would somehow encourage them to embrace being bold. But in the original book outline, it wasn't the book you have now read. In the original book outline, there was only going to be a single chapter on lessons from the Second World War, because I had long been intrigued by the war as this example of rapid mm-hmm. economic transformation. But then I started, and I'm not a historian, I'm a political scientist, but the more I dug into that research, I started to see more and more parallels. And not just on the economic front, but on a whole bunch of fronts, including more of the domain in which you work. And plus I was talking to writers who were saying, you gotta have, if you're writing a book after 22 years of writing policy reports, you got to have narrative, you got to have story. And so there was lots of story there. And I thought, oh, this is good. I rewrote the whole outline. But interestingly, David, even though I've been working with this material for many years, it jolted my own thinking about emergencies. It made me think newly about the problems. In a way that we all have to a certain extent in the pandemic. So that's how I came to this framework. And I wouldn't have anticipated the part I didn't anticipate, but have come to really appreciate in these 8 months of being out with the book, is how remarkably resonant this story mm-hmm. remains 80 years later for so many people.
And in a way, how relevant it feels to the crisis we're living in the other crisis we're living in right now when it comes to the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Let's just take listeners who may not have read the book, but I encourage them all to go and pick up a copy of it, about this, the central thesis, which is, as you already alluded to, that, you know, we have an example of not just our country, but the globe and much of the globe mobilizing to confront one challenge and crisis, that being Nazism, you know, and the war, World War II. Take us through the argument and some of the examples of what Canada did then, probably remarkably to people after the fact, or at least before, to respond to that crisis.
Mm-hmm. Well, the overall comparison is based on the fact that they were both existential threats, or that was an existential threat in the same way that climate is an existential threat. And they require meeting the moment of these threats is an inherently collective undertaking, requiring a society-wide mobilization and a huge-scale economic transformation. That's the main parallel. But then, as I said before, you see all these other parallels. For example, like many people, I assumed initially that at the outbreak of World War II, everyone was all on board and everyone was ready to rally. And it turns out that's not true. You know, we, you know, when I started to tell people I was going to use this framework, people would often say, oh yeah, but then everyone understood the threat to be clear and present. No, they didn't. You know, the threat was on the other side of two oceans. And so partly I take solace from this, right? That as with all emergencies begin with a period of denial. Right, we all knew what that was like 12 months ago when we started to hear reports of this virus, and yet we weren't there yet. Right, we didn't know how it would upend our whole lives, well, all of our lives. And so there's always this alchemy of what's the combination of events and leadership that gets us all on board. Once that shift occurred in the war, what happened was extraordinary, right? That level of mobilization. Out of a population of about 11 million at the time, over a million Canadians enlisted. That is an extraordinary figure. Over a million were directly employed in military production. All those people had to be recruited and trained up. And then 6 years later, they all had to be reconverted back to a peacetime economy, right? So we only have to transition once today. They actually transitioned twice in the space of 6 years. And mostly the book deals not with the battlefront, but with the home front and that remarkable undertaking of, you know, going from a base of virtually nothing to building 800,000 military vehicles, more than Germany, Italy, and Japan combined, 16,000 military aircraft, building the fourth largest air force in the world at the time. You know, here in my province in British Columbia, where we seem to struggle to build a single BC ferry anymore, we built over 300 ships in the space of that time. So I emerged from this study with what I now call my four markers of when you know that a government's in emergency mode. And they are, number one, you spend what it takes to win. Number two, you create new economic institutions to get the job done. Number three, you move from voluntary and incentive-based policies to mandatory measures as needed. And number four, you tell the truth. Tell the truth about the severity of the crisis and what we have to do. We did all those things in the war. I would actually say the Trudeau government hits all four of those markers on the pandemic,
yeah,
and none of them on climate.
That's really interesting. I mean, that's a great framework, because as soon as you went through them, I was using the current context and said, yeah, check. Established, you know, instantly almost, it felt like, CERB and support programs that people would say, oh, government slow and moves, you know, it takes years. No, within weeks they had
a
national program in place to support people.
Can I just say something on that? Like, this is where I pull some hope. Like, if you had said to Canadians in 1938, this gang in Mackenzie King's government, do they have what it takes to completely transform Canadian society? I'm certain most Canadians would have said no. They had no evidence to believe otherwise. Mm-hmm. You know, this was not a government that had risen to the moment on the Depression, and yet they did. And similarly, as you just said, if you had said to me a year ago, or just over a year ago, are there people at Finance Canada and the Bank of Canada who could quickly pivot and create the CERB and the wage subsidy and the Bank of Canada financing it all to the tune of $5 billion a week? I would have said, no, there's nobody home who thinks that way. And I would have been wrong.
So then the question is, why can't we do this on climate? So let's explore that. Before we do, though, this is a podcast about public opinion, politics, public policy, and the intersection of the three. I had the pleasure of working with you, it was a real pleasure. We did some polling for your book that you helped guide, and you know, let's start with the hypothesis, and then we'll go through a few of the results. And that hypothesis, when we first spoke, was you said, David, I firmly believe that the public is ahead of our leaders, of all political stripes, that they want more action than leaders think they do. Explain that gut sense that you had that sort of sparked the work we then did.
Yeah, well, I think it's more accurately described as a gut feeling than as a firm belief. It was my suspicion. Let me say, by the way, it was a pleasure. I'm so glad I found my way to you. And in fact, you were guiding me on how to ask these questions. But the impetus was, I interviewed a lot of politicians and political insiders for the book. And I was only interested in interviewing political leaders who I believe actually get the science, mm-hmm. and yet whose governments are not doing what we have to do. And I wanted to know why. And invariably, they all fell back on some variant of the rejoinder, well, you got to meet the public where they're at, and the public's not there yet. So I found that a very annoying answer, in part because I was also looking at this war story and marveling at these leaders who didn't meet the public where they were at, but took the public where they needed to go. But I still felt like testing the presumption, and that's what brought me to you. I wanted to know if that was in fact true. And it was also my feeling and frustration that so much of the climate polling to that point was screwed up. no offense to you and your colleagues, but it's also a bit of a critique of the environmental groups and their funders who had come to so many pollsters over so many years asking incremental questions. Mm. That at this late hour are of no consequence. And I wanted to know what people thought about non-incremental questions.
Right. So let me just take our listeners through a little bit of what we found. So we did a large survey back in, I believe it was 2018-19. I think it was.
When we did
it was
the survey? It was 19. It was all in the summer of
2019, sorry. Now I will say, I looked at these results and then I've gone back to a few things we've done, and nothing has really changed. In fact, I think the pandemic has caused some people to feel the emergency a little bit more now. So I think these are still really relevant. At the time we did the survey, we showed that the public is increasingly worried about climate change. 82% rated it as a serious, extremely serious or serious problem. One out of four Canadians said they think about it all the time. Another half say they're increasingly getting worried about it. So there's this momentum. 42% described it as an emergency at that moment. That would win a majority government in Canada. 20% mm-hmm. then another 20 said, but it will be one in the next few years. So there's a super majority headed your way. I think importantly, you know, climate change, and we've seen this over the last, I think, decade, it's moved from an abstract concept to something real for people. Forest fires in BC and Alberta, flooding in too many places, rising sea levels on east and west coasts. And so that people increasingly were saying they're feeling it in their day-to-day lives. And then we tested a whole bunch of, you know, big ideas, as you said, right? But and we found broad support for almost everything. But the thing that really stands out is 80% of Canadians said that they were ready for a major transition, and that transition to clean energy was needed. Now, obviously, we're not going to go into the details. We know where more resistance is going to be. And I think that was part of your talk about a just transition and making sure that what we need to do deals with folks who work in the oil and gas sector and the energy sector. But the big picture here, I think, is, and this was now 2 years ago, that already at the time, there was evidence, multiple questions asked different ways. I think that the country was ready for what you were proposing. They just needed some leaders to guide them and bring them with, you know, to make it all make sense. As you said, those four pillars. So when you got the initial results and you started to sort of analyze them and say, how do these fit in the book? What did this research tell you about the state of public opinion around climate change in the country?
Well, so first of all, it confirmed my gut, which is that the public is ahead of our politics when it comes to the climate emergency, both in terms of seeing and understanding it to be an emergency and in terms of their willingness to accept truly bold climate policies, by which I mean policies that go well beyond what any federal or provincial government is currently offering. And as you say, on the first of those, that the terrain had in fact shifted. I don't think I would have had the same results 2 years earlier, that the combination, particularly extreme weather events and the student strikes, I would say, were shifting the terrain of public opinion, and that people were moving from seeing climate as a threat somewhere else, sometime in the future, to here to now. As you alluded to, you do get these regional differences where, you know, support and understanding is sort of at a high in Quebec and a low in Alberta. But even in Alberta, the results were pretty darn good. And I think, you know, I actually spent a chunk of one of the chapters of the book delving specifically into those Alberta results, because I think it's important not to let Jason Kenney define the political culture of Alberta. It's a lot more complex. So the support for bold action was there. I found some resonance around that wartime footing. But, you know, well, there's a couple other important things that came out of this. One has to do with the connection with inequality. And there too, there's an interesting comparison out of the wartime story. But there are a lot of climate policy purists out there who say, don't link climate to, you know, fighting inequality and social justice and all these things. Don't make it more complicated. It's hard enough as it is. And I think they're wrong. They're wrong because, first of all, these are connected, right? The richer you are, the higher your emissions. The poorer you are, the more vulnerable you are to climate change. But what the polling shows is you should link these things because that's how we win. So we had the questions in the poll with you that asked people about their willingness to support or accept bold climate actions. Then we asked a series of questions which said, well, would your support go up and down or down if we did this by increasing taxes on the wealthy and corporations, by increasing transfers to low and modest income people, by offering a good jobs guarantee to fossil fuel workers? And on every one of those, when you link it that way, the support for the bold climate action doesn't go down, it goes through the roof. And you end up, similarly, when you present a definition of the Green New Deal to people linking climate and inequality, you get levels of support that go well beyond what any political party in this country gets. So that was neat. But I do recognize, and I talk about this a bit in the book, the opinion picture is more muddy than what my poll with you showed. More recently, I've seen some stuff showing that you basically have like 25% of the public that's the climate alarmed. And then you get almost half the public who are this group in the middle who are worried. They know we need to do something. Their understanding of what causes climate change and what to do about it is abysmal. The level of literacy just is appalling.
Yes.
And frankly, this is the group that the Liberals can make all kinds of mischief with, because it doesn't take much to tell these people, to give these people the impression that you're doing something when you're not.
Right.
And I think in the face of that large group in the middle, this kind of movable middle group, the leadership has been incredibly lacking, and that political leaders, instead of engaging these folks to explain why and how we need to meet this moment, they're reinforcing the confusion and the contradiction with untrue messages like we can take climate action and still expand fossil fuel production. They're not being straight and honest. And I don't think history is going to look kindly upon that kind of leadership at all.
Just on a point about the sort of lack of, I don't know, climate literacy, let's call it. I did some focus groups with so-called swing voters in like suburban Toronto before the last election. And a basic question when we ask, what's causing climate change? The answers, like, they're shocking. People said garbage.
Yeah, they go right to plastics.
People aren't recycling enough, yeah. Right? Like, yeah. And, or when you ask them, what's the solution? Recycle more, right? And recycling will help, but as you point out in this book, not nearly enough, anywhere near what we need to do. So yes, that, I think that's a big challenge. And how do you, and the only way you do that is by bringing leaders into the place. I do want your take on what you make of the challenges the federal Conservative Party, in fact, many provincial Conservative parties are having on the issue of climate change. You know, a few weeks ago, they had that debacle of a convention in which Erin O'Toole stood up and said, hey, folks, we need to change. We need to be bold. And then a majority of their party members wouldn't even pass a motion saying that climate change is real. What do you make of that?
I think it's unfortunate. And it's unfortunate because it didn't need to be this way. You know, even though in this case, it was the membership that voted the way they did, it speaks to an indictment of their leadership up to this point. Real leaders in the face of the climate emergency would be animating these deep conservative values of national security and protection of children and pride in one's country's capacity to confront challenges with innovation and determination. And that's not what we've been getting. It's also unfortunate because the dynamic of questioning the science has not been true of conservative parties in many other places, right? Like if you look at the G7 countries that have seen the most progress on cutting emissions, the two best performers are the UK and Germany. Much of that has happened under conservative leadership. But those countries have national cross-partisan agreement on the need to tackle climate. But it seems, in particular to North America, but a few other places too, where conservative party leaders have chosen to stoke doubt about the science, often because the leadership is so embedded with the fossil fuel industry. Mm-hmm. And it's a tragedy because the role of conservative leaders in the war, of course, was quite different, right? To the extent that the conservatives critiqued the King government, it was for failing to prosecute the war forcefully enough. Mm. And in contrast to today's conservative leaders who throw these temper tantrums and say, you know, don't make us do it. World War II conservative leaders, you know, rallied us and told us we could.
It's, you know, as the research we did together shows, there's a clear vast majority on action, but because of the way I think conservative leaders have talked about this issue and or refused to even talk about it, they don't even talk about it, it's become the most partisanly divisive issue in the country right now, right? There's no other issue except for whether they like Justin Trudeau or not that divides conservative Canada from the rest of the country, and climate change is that issue.
Right? Not that always.
It wasn't always.
I want to say, but even today, so it's true federally, it's true in many provinces. It's not true in Quebec, where there's this consensus. And so, you know, across the political spectrum, they compete to say who's got the better plan. And if I can offer one hopeful story that I tell in the book, it's not true where I live in Vancouver. Now, I'm very biased in this story, David, because my wife is the Vancouver City Councillor who moved the climate emergency motion a couple of years ago, Christine Boyle. And for anyone who follows Vancouver politics these days, you'll know that no party has a majority. It's a very divided council. They're all over the political spectrum. You never know how this gang's gonna vote, David. When Chris brought her climate emergency motions forward, she thought she was pretty confident she had enough votes to win, but didn't know by how much. And they ended up passing unanimously. Now, how did that happen? Partially, it happened because she's really good at her job. But it also happened, she would say, because each time those votes occurred, dozens of high school students skipped class to be there. They rallied outside. They spoke before council. They filled the galleries. And they watched. And they basically made it impossible for even the conservative councillors to vote no. Mm-hmm. And so climate is not a political wedge issue here.
The pandemic, I think, provides us with a really unfortunate but useful case study. And, you know, when if you were to ask people, and this is where I think two points about leadership that are important. As a social scientist that studies behavioral change and opinion change, one of the most remarkable things is how quickly we changed our views and our behavior when it came to something like wearing a mask. Mm-hmm. That when our leaders got up and uniformly said, put on a mask, wear it when you're out, wear it all the time, and then said, no, you have to wear it. It's now required. Well, guess what? We all wear masks pretty much, right? There's the odd exception, but they are like the 5% who don't believe climate change is happening.
But by the way, I mean, the parallels here are so interesting because like with the climate polling, my observation is that the public was ahead of our politics. The public was saying, make it mandatory, make it mandatory. Yes. And the politicians had to catch up. And this speaks to my third marker around making things moving from voluntary to mandatory. And I think the same is true on climate. Part of why I think the public actually wants these things to be mandatory is because in the main, the vast majority of us want to do the right thing. But it irks us and we don't want to be chumps if we're going to do it and our neighbor isn't. And the great thing about making things mandatory is you don't have to worry about your neighbor. They're going to have to do it.
How many times I was just speaking with my partner, my spouse, and saying, I just wish they would put roadblocks up between Ottawa and Toronto so no one could go visit their family. I hadn't seen my family in five months. And I didn't go. I followed the rules, but I knew others were, and it kind of irked me. You're right. Like it's so make it mandatory, enforce it, and I'll feel good. I won't feel like you're repressing my rights or making it, you know, because it's the right thing to do. I think the other thing that the pandemic taught me that I think connects back to your thesis is, you know, the economic consequences of the pandemic were deeply severe, but they weren't universal, right? There's actually it's increased inequality. There's like a third of the country right now that are better off as a result of the pandemic. They have more money in their bank accounts. They haven't lost any hours. And yet they went along and generally supported with a pretty significant amount of enthusiasm the amount of money that the government spent to help those who were affected by this, mm-hmm. right?
Well,
and that to me is an interesting lesson that this idea that, you know, and to your point that this mobilization and the amount of money and investment we need to make it happen, I think you can find common ground among most people in the country to do it, even if some have to pay more or some, you know, might be worried about deficits or overspending, but at the end of the day, know it's the thing we have to do to help each other and protect each other. So I do think there's a parallel that we now know how the public would react to these.
Well, let's separate out economic consequences and fiscal consequences. On the economic front, I think you're absolutely right. And one of the lessons I delve into in the book is that inequality itself is toxic to the social solidarity you need for mass mobilization. Hmm. In the First World War, just to go further back in history, inequality and rampant profiteering, just grotesque profiteering, had undermined social solidarity and it had actually undermined recruitment efforts. The King government was acutely aware of this. And so they bring in measures to tackle inequality at the beginning of the Second World War. They brought in an excess profits tax. So to your point a moment ago, this pandemic, we have seen, you know, one segment of the population fare quite just fine. And in fact, the very wealthy in Canada, the richest few dozen families, have seen their net wealth increase by billions since the first lockdown. That kind of profiteering was illegal in the Second World War, right? They actually brought in an excess profits tax where if your profits surpassed what they were on average in the years just before the war, your top marginal tax rate went to 100%. That's what they did in the war. Because they knew that if you're asking people to make great sacrifices, you had to have social solidarity. You truly had to demonstrate that everyone was in. And we've missed that in this pandemic.
I don't think we know what the consequence, like the social solidarity consequences of that are, right? We're still living through this crisis, but in the months after it's all done, that's the moment in which the consequences of that, I think, are going to be felt in terms of our cohesion and how our country kind of holds itself together.
Absolutely. And I think it's why, you know, you've done polling, I know, on the question of wealth taxes. And I think it's why right now people are really clamoring for that. On the fiscal consequences, you know, this is where I take some hope out of this pandemic experience. We have racked up a big increase in the debt to GDP ratio this year from about 30% to 50%. That still pales in comparison, by the way, to what happened in the war. We came out of the war with the debt to GDP ratio well over 100%, more than double. And almost all of that has been is now held by the Bank of Canada, right? As I was mentioning before, they've been buying up government securities at this extraordinary rate. So to me, what the pandemic experience has laid bare is what was possible all along to confront climate and homelessness and poverty. Like, it turns out that, just like Tommy Douglas predicted before the war, that when a government recognizes an emergency, the money is always there. And now we just have to direct it towards this task of our lives.
Interesting. One other point, and then we can look to close this. It's been really great conversation. I think the other thing that you mentioned it earlier, you know, the science of climate change. We don't debate it, thankfully, as much anymore, but there's still, to create that sense of urgency, right? You still have to really believe the science. And I think one of the things personally I've taken from this, and our research backs it up, is that coming out of this pandemic, there will be a moment where more people will trust scientists, more people will want scientists helping make decisions and being, you know, it was funny. I was recording another podcast this morning that will come out right before our conversation. And we were talking about how political leaders, you know, have had to have an accountability, someone who's holding them accountable, sitting right beside them in these press conferences, right? So on the one hand, you've got the health minister, and then beside her, you've got Dr. Tam, right? And so you can only say, you can't get away with saying things that aren't fully true or don't express. Imagine you had the provincial or federal minister of the environment and climate change and a press conference with Canada's, you know, chief scientists sitting beside them saying, you know, there to offer their view, right? Like there's been an accountability during this pandemic that we don't see in a lot of other policy areas for government. And so I do think that that'll be interesting to see how that develops, right? Will there be a greater demand for that? Or will political leaders probably return to what they'd prefer, which is less direct accountability and having somebody who actually knows the science and can articulate it, not sitting beside them. But I do think that I have learned, as I'm living through, and you are in Vancouver, this third wave, and every epidemiologist, every scientist who knows this stuff said, this one will be worse, and it's going to be more devastating, and didn't feel like our political leaders responded in the right way, and here we are, right?
Yeah.
And so, again, another lesson of this pandemic that I think can only help the cause you were fighting for, and I am with you on it in terms of us wanting to see this dealt with, but I think the public will also appreciate that in a way that they wouldn't have before this pandemic. In fact, we saw, you know, trust in scientists was headed down, not up. I think it's restored our faith in rational, scientific exploration and discovery.
The same dynamic you're describing with government and scientists has also been notably true with the media, right? In when it comes to climate, the media had this ridiculous compulsion to kind of give equal space and time to both sides. Mm-hmm. And yet we've not seen that compulsion at all when it came to the pandemic on the part of the vast majority of media. So I think by and large, we will emerge from this pandemic. First of all, we now have this modern reminder of what emergencies are supposed to look like and feel like compared to the lackadaisical approach on climate. We'll see where we land on social solidarity. I'm still cautiously optimistic, notwithstanding the profiteering. But I think you're absolutely right that we emerge with a new appreciation of the role of public services, respect for science and scientists. We all have this evidence of how quickly we're capable of moving, and it just lays bare the speed and scale of what's possible.
So let's wrap up on a positive note then. You know, as you have, you know, virtually toured the country, talking to Canadians about your book and sharing, are you more hopeful today about our ability to do what you've outlined?
I am. I am, but both out of our pandemic experience and this little historic project, both are this reminder of what of the speed and scale that we are capable of once we recognize an emergency. Your hope question is always a bit, it's always a bit fraught for me, because if I were a betting man, do I think we will do what we need to do in time? I don't know. I mean, it's a very much an open question, and I often don't feel optimistic about that. I do take some solace, again, from the war story, which is, you know, I mentioned the level of mobilization earlier, over 1 million enlistments out of 11 million people. But you know what those people didn't know? They didn't know if they would win, but they did it anyway. And maybe that's as good as we can do right now.
Right.
And I do, you know, we've been talking about all these comparisons with COVID, but here's an important difference. Like, you know, everyone's wrestling with COVID fatigue. And I've had people hear my thesis and say, oh, well, you know, look how tired people have grown of emergency in the space of a year. And now here I am asking people to be in emergency mode for a few years. But here's the difference. Everything that we are urged to do in response to the pandemic is anathema to all of our social instincts. Stay home, isolate. That's hard. And the good news about the climate emergency is what we are called upon to do is precisely the opposite, to go out and do something grand together. And we can do that for a few years.
Well, that is a great way to end this conversation. Thank you, Seth. I learned more here in our conversation. And I'm not going to, you know, create more work for you, but I suspect you may need a second edition of your book to add on a chapter on the pandemic when this is all over, because I think there's a lot of parallels. Thank you very much. And I hope you're safe and your next, I know you've got some exciting work ahead, and thanks for writing this book and telling the story.
Thanks, Aaron.